penalty from any civil or criminal liability for this wrongful conduct. SB 679 simply reverses the situation and says that a person who knowingly and intentionally submits a false complaint or testimony shall not have immunity from civil or criminal liability. The industry met with Senior Disabled Services Division, and we agreed to add a second sentence, which they insisted upon. Quote, it says, staff, residents, family, or others shall not be prohibited, discouraged, or in any way intimidated from making complaints, close quote. We think that the final language is balanced and fair. It establishes an expectation and a standard of truthfulness in public affairs, while at the same time, in our opinion, it does not have a chilling effect on legitimate complaints. Being able to fabricate a story and then rely upon the statutory law for immunity protection, in our view, is not right. The idea of being held accountable for what you say and do just seems unacceptable. Not being held accountable for what you say and do seems unacceptable on its face. This bill passed the Senate last week 27-0, and we urge the committee to support it and give it your recommendation to the full committee. That concludes my written testimony, but I did cut an article from the Oregonian yesterday that relates to a similar principle, and that's the bill called SLAP, and it cites Senator Neil Bryant. His observation was this. He objected to several key features, especially a provision that would give witnesses immunity for their statements, whether or not they were accurate, so long as they were relevant to the issue. He said that such blanket immunity, quote, encouraged irresponsible speech, close quote, and that citizens have a responsibility to do enough research to make sure their testimony is accurate. Well, I think that's a related concept and related principle. We believe that people who file complaints against adult foster homes should be truthful. And if they're not, they ought to be held accountable for their actions. And that's the simple upshot and impact of the bill. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mrs. Henson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Just one second, Representative Gardner.
Yeah, Mr. Stearns, you know, you're talking about this in the hypothetical, but usually there are things that bring about bills like this. Are there particular situations of someone knowingly and intentionally filing these, or particular situations you've had dealings with?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, yes, there are indeed, and Mrs. Ankrum will put into the record written testimony from three witnesses who could not be here today, and there was another witness from Joseph, Oregon, who there just wasn't enough lead time and notice for him to be here today, Mr. David Brandt. And if there, in fact, had been a lot of lead time, we could have filled the room with people who have specific complaints where untruthful allegations have been lodged against them and the frustration that caused. Actually, Representative Gardner, that's endemic to this industry. I've represented the foster home industry for 14 years and testified down here over the years, and year in and year out, we have known and been made aware of cases where there have been false accusations against foster homes, and you can't do anything about it. So we had a bill 2 years ago dealing with this, and it didn't get passed, but that's the answer.
Chair, if I might, making false statements is one thing. Knowingly and intentionally making false statements is another. I guess what I'm looking for, and apparently you're going to bring it up in your testimony, of specific instances.
Yes, I have them. My name is Shirlene Ankrum, for the record. I represent the Adult Foster Care Providers of Oregon. I'm currently serving as their executive director. I own two adult foster care homes, which I do not operate at this time, but I have for the last several years. In the capacity of executive director, I have been traveling throughout the state and accompanying providers to hearings, and many of them our wrongful complaints. Many times it is used like an employee will be fired for just cause, or, you know, or they'll quit because they're mad, and then they'll go and they'll just call up and say, you need to go and look into these people because they're not doing things correctly, or they're not keeping meds. And in two instances, I don't have the written document for that, but I know of two instances where that employee actually took documents out of the home and then said, you need to go check to this because they don't have these documents. And the provider is held liable for this, and she has no way to hold them liable.
But, Mr. Chair, I mean, I understand you believe that's what happened, but can you legally, you know, in the court of law, prove that employee actually did that, or is it just your belief versus...
In most cases, they felt they could prove it, but their proof was not looked at by the investigating people, even though when they said, well, you come back, it's here. And like in the one instance, and I'll submit this as written evidence, but what happened was the investigator came while the provider was away, and the care provider said, oh, I don't know where that is, or we don't have that. But when the provider came home, it was there. That type of thing. Many times it's used. I can say things about you and you can't do anything about it. This does happen. And we're not saying that we want, you know, that we want people that have a true complaint, or they feel that they have a true complaint. All we're saying is when we can prove that it is unjust and that it was frivolous, then we can do something about it. Then they do not have immunity. At this point, we have no way of even knowing who does it. We can't even find out who is saying these things about it. I'll go on with what I wrote down. I'm sorry, I got away from there.
Have you introduced yourself?
Yes, I'm Shirley Nankrum. Didn't I do that? I'm sorry. My name is Shirley.
I'm sorry.
Okay, currently I keep a level of all adult foster homes in the state. I do this, I get a report from every state, every licensing agency in the state monthly, and I update it. I just finished this one, and for the first month of July, I removed approximately a third more adult foster homes than I added via relicensing. So I called a few of these, just a random selection, to see why they were going out of business. And almost all of them said, because I can't fight anymore. It's just one after another after another. And even if they're not substantiated, you still have that stigma of when somebody comes in, all of those complaints are in the file, even though they're not substantiated, so they were not just. Okay. I feel that the ultimate result of the established providers closing their businesses and new providers starting, the quality of the elderly is what suffered and is going to suffer, the quality of the care. Ultimately, many of these providers will in turn be have to be provided for because they won't be able to make a living. Many of these people, this is how they make their living, and they're not, they do a good job, but they can't fight City Hall by themselves. Please consider the whole picture when you consider this bill. I think it's really important for the care of our elderly. I think that adult foster care fills a very large void. I don't think that we want to see it out of business entirely, but that's where it's going. Providers just can't fight. Any other questions?
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Thank you both. Appreciate your time. Nelson Rubes.
Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. My name is Nelson Grubb. I live in 455 Alexander Loop in Eugene. I'm a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. We've reviewed this bill and we oppose it. Our first concern at the commission is the quality of care of the people that live there. Require constant 24-hour care for their well-being, in fact, for their whole life. We do not wish to penalize cause any undue hardships to the operators of these adult foster homes. They are very important to the community-based care system that we have in Oregon, and we want to encourage them. There are over 18,000 foster homes in Oregon, and we know of actually no lawsuit that's been brought to our attention that has involved a claim of this kind. I practiced law in Oregon for some time a few years ago, and it's my recollection that under common law, anyone who makes a willful false statement can be held accountable for it that causes harm. And I'm sure that's still the law in Oregon. This is, I think, a redundance of the law that now applies. It's very clear, as it states in my testimony, that written testimony, that the statute goes to the concern of the goodwill or the good faith of the person making the complaint. Complaints are a very necessary part of the system of adult foster care. The patient or the person who's receiving the care is often not able to make the complaints. So it falls to someone else who is watching this sort of thing. And to be sure, complaints against an operator are very emotional and are very concerned of the operator. But I think that you'll find that the present law covers this situation there's no need to make it into a statute. We think that it does have a possibility of a chilling effect upon complaints that should be made. And for that reason, we've asked that we've opposed this bill, and we asked the commission or the committee to oppose it also. I appreciate your time and hearing of this, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions?
No questions. Thank you very much. Mr. Neville and Ms. Dash.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm David Niebel from the Oregon Law Center. I'm also appearing today on behalf of the Citizens Coalition for Quality Long-Term Care and United Seniors of Oregon to oppose Senate Bill 679. We think that current law is adequate to cover this problem, and we also think that this bill is unnecessary. I would note for those members who may not be aware, this bill was considered several months ago in the House Human Resources Committee and did not move out of that committee. The proponents have said that they want to clarify what this bill is about, is clarifying the immunity protection for people who file complaints about adult foster care facilities and to make it easier to hold people accountable who make false complaints. And I would say that this bill fails on both of those objectives. I think it's worth looking at what the current law is. The current law already contains a standard of immunity. In the same section that's being amended here, it says anyone participating in good faith in the making of a complaint who has reasonable grounds for the making thereof shall have immunity from any liability, civil or criminal, that might otherwise be incurred or imposed with respect to the making or content of that complaint. Put differently, a person doesn't have immunity if they either make the complaint in bad faith, if the complaint is not in good faith, or if they make it without a reasonable basis. And so I think that the proponents of this bill are mistaken when they say that under current law, someone can file a completely false complaint. If they file a completely false complaint, the complaint is not in good faith, or the complainant does not have a reasonable basis to make it. So I think that those people under current law are not immune from civil or criminal liability. Now, I don't know why it is that this hasn't been litigated, but I know of no cases where this section of the statute has been interpreted. This bill would insert in that same section that I just read an additional standard of immunity regulating the same complaints. Wrong providers, if this bill passed, they'd have to show that either the complaint was made without a reasonable basis or made in bad faith, and that the person who made it knowing that it was in false and knowing that it was false and intending to make the complaint that was false. So, in effect, this raises the bar for the proponents of the bill in pursuing people who make false complaints. I would say that the effect of this bill is anything but clarification and streamlining. And I'm afraid that the result of this bill, as the last witness suggested, might be killing people from making complaints that are legitimate. I think that people who don't really know what this bill is about will say, providers may say, well, we just had the legislature pass a law that says that any false complaint, if your complaint turns out to be false, you're not immune. I'm really worried that people will be discouraged from making complaints. I know that there is that language in the bill that says otherwise, but I think that may be the effect anyway. The proponents also said that one problem that they were trying to deal with was that they didn't sometimes know who was making these complaints. This bill doesn't address that issue. So I think that the current law is not broken. I think that this is an attempt to fix a law that's not broken, and I would urge you to reject this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Representative Byers?
Thank you. Did you raise these same concerns in the Senate?
I did, Representative Byers.
Another question. I'm looking now, we're looking at an amended bill. It significantly changed. That's why. So you did make these objections to this version of the bill, not the original bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byers, that's correct. I did that in the Senate Human Resources Committee. It was called something else, but Health and Human Services Committee. And also, I believe I appeared in the House Human Resources Committee, although if I'm not mistaken, that was a work session in which there wasn't really testimony elicited. And I also appeared in the Senate Rules Committee on when this was gutted and stuff, basically.
Thank you.
Any questions, Representative Dunham?
During the first two previous potential hearings on this, it didn't include the language that was added later, correct? The portion asked, requested by FDIC, the an owner or operator of an adult foster care may not prohibit, discourage, or intimidate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, that has been in the bill in the draft that was considered in the Senate originally, also in the House Human Resources Committee several months ago.
And just to verify, what was the Senate vote on this bill?
This bill originally passed the Senate, I believe it was roughly 20-10. That's a rough estimate. It got no votes the second time through the Senate. No one voted against it.
27-0
as A and Grove.
Why did it pass the Senate twice?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I'm talking about the Senate has considered this exact language on the floor twice. Once in Senate Bill 421, which is the original bill that was considered by the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. That bill passed the Senate floor. That bill died in the House Human Resources Committee. Senate Bill 679 was identified as a vehicle for this language again. Again, this exact language passed the Senate floor a second time. So that's how it was considered on the Senate floor twice.
I understand your concern on the language being added, if it had been added in the previous language in Section 7 had been deleted. But the previous language in Section 7 is still there. So it's stating after both sides of the question, it's stating overtly what you believe to be the current law, basically.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, I think that's correct. The problem with the bill, I think, if I'm right, is that I think it, for someone who comes upon this language, say a lawyer in a law office who is trying to counsel someone who wants to assert a complaint against someone who's made a false complaint, I think that they would find this language very confusing. Because it seems to establish two separate standards of immunity for the same class of complaints. And then there's that added language about not discouraging people from making complaints. I don't think that there's been a case made why the existing law does not cover this adequately.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question of a different attorney, Representative Manning. Do you find this new language to make the law more confusing than what currently is?
Actually, no. It's probably not written as artfully as someone who was just trying to write something simply and wasn't a lawyer might do, but I could see how this works out if I can respond, Mr. Chairman. If you look at the first part of subsection 7, participating in good faith in making a complaint, that's interesting the way that's described, participating in good faith. Good faith just means that you are of good heart and you're trying to do the right thing, that part, okay. In making a complaint pursuant to this section, who has reasonable grounds for the making thereof. You have reasonable grounds to make a complaint, and you're acting in good faith. All right, there's a concept. Has immunity, blah, 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 blah. All right. This part, the second part, the new part says, if the complainant, participant, or witness knowingly and intentionally submits a false complaint or testimony. Now, that's pretty strong there. You've got to know what you're doing, you have to intend to do it, and you're submitting a false complaint or testimony. Now, that's different from the first part. The first part talks about participating in good faith. You, in good faith, may have reasonable grounds to believe somebody has done wrong, but you could still knowingly and intentionally submit a false complaint or testimony. In other words, I believe in the righteousness of my cause, and I so believe in it. And I have some basis to believe in it, but I'm going to lie about some aspect of it, knowingly and intentionally submit a false complaint or testimony. Now, I would agree that I'm a lawyer and I'm parsing this off, and I would agree with the testimony to the effect that this isn't the clearest thing in the world, but what it does is it's a limitation on the exception from liability in the first place. And what it really is a bright red warning sign to plaintiff's lawyers and to everybody else out there, at least be truthful when you are putting in a complaint. My example would be, suppose I truly believe that somebody was giving out bad drugs, out-of-date drugs. I really am participating in good faith because I want to help these folks not get bad drugs. And so I'm acting in good faith. And I reasonably believe that bad drugs are being given out. But in order to make the case, I say that last night at 8 p.m. I saw John Smith hand out outdated drugs.
I have just knowingly and intentionally made a false statement because I know it's not true. But I'm doing it in terms of a complaint where I really believe in what I'm doing. And because I had gotten some complaints from other people over time that there had been some bad drugs around, I had some reasonable belief in the general complaint, the concept of bad drugs being distributed, even though the specific information I presented was intentionally false. Now, I know that's a pretty strange construct, and given a few weeks' time, maybe we'd work up some pressure language, but this case sends a warning signal. If you're going to have a reasonable basis for your complaint, you better also be truthful and honest about what you say. That's what this tells you. And if you're not protected from lying, I hope that answered the question. No, I was going to try to make that sort of point. That's why I appreciate the question.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Vice Chair Starr and members of the committee, my name is Mae Dash, and I speak for the Oregon chapters of the Alzheimer's Association. We are a public policy coalition of the Oregon chapters of the National Association, and we represent persons afflicted with Alzheimer's disease and related diseases and their families. More than 60% of the residents in adult foster care homes suffer from dementia, primarily of the Alzheimer's type. We strongly oppose Senate Bill 679. It is a great concern to us, the proposed modification. Many residents in long-term care settings, as well as their families, feel as though they are held hostage. They are afraid to report their concerns or grievances, even to staff, for fear of retaliation or eviction. Adult foster care homes are very small, often are very isolated. Residents who usually must depend upon the goodwill of a single caregiver commonly have no outside visitors. Not being familiar with long-term care law, some will assume that if they make a legitimate complaint that somehow is misconstrued by the industry as untruthful, they will be faced with a lawsuit. Senate Bill 679 has the potential for frightening these extremely vulnerable persons and their families into remaining silent. Also, facility caregivers, even if aware that something is seriously wrong, may decide not to file complaints for fear of being taken to court. Regarding this immunity issue, the Oregon chapters urge you to leave the law as it currently is written, and we thank you for your consideration of our concerns.
Thank you very much. Any questions from this staff? Thank you both. Thank you. That's fine for me.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 679? Okay, thank you. We will close the work session, public hearing work session on Senate Bill 679.
Recommendation.
And a motion to move 679 to the floor to be passed. Any discussion on the motion? President Edwards?
That would be Edwards down there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the record, I'll be a note. I believe this could serve as an intimidation factor to those people who wish to serve out complaints, and I believe there is adequate protections within the current law, and lacking some real specific examples of the deep need for it at the moment, I think current law is perfectly adequate, and I'll be another day.
Very good. Any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk call the roll.
Representative
Byron.
Motion passes. Okay. Mr. Chair, notice the intent of a possible minority report.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Okay. Another one of those. Motion passes. The necessary vote.
Sure.
President Mann, who carries the bill? We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 679. Yep.
Open work session on Senate Bill 535 and the elusive fiscal and revenue statements that we were not available to us yesterday are available to us now. Our staff is able to get those out for us. And Mr. Moore, please give us an overview.
Mr. Chair, staff received both the fiscal and revenue statements just a few minutes before the meeting. And if there are no other changes, the committee did adopt the dance formulas at the last meeting. So, modified the federal tax income to increase the federal income tax pressure.
You got some federal income tax.
Yeah.
Okay. And we did amend that into the bill, and we and Representative Edwards had some dash A6 amendments.
Yeah. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would ask that we suspend the rules for a conceptual amendment to the A6. I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment. I couldn't get down to make a change
to the A6.
Yeah.
We would need to adopt them into the bill first, I think. Pardon the procedure here.
Well, Mr. Chair, you could conceptually amend the amendment before you adopt into the bill.
You've already adopted the amendment into the bill.
It's done with the A6s.
Okay.
Before we go down that road, I'd like to know whatever we'd like to do with the amendment before we.
Mr. Chair, and again, as I stated yesterday for the record, when I first drafted this amendment, it was to parallel what we were going to do with capital gains tax, in which case the revenue and tax were roughly parallel. This bill, or the dash A4s, I believe what we adopted, and now that we have a clearer picture of what those do, are not, it's a little different impact. I don't know what the outlays are. I assume it's still around 200 and some odd million. And what I'd like to do, if you look at what the revenue impact on this measure was as written, for the first 01, 03 biennium, it was $262 million. So the conceptual amendment would basically not change to allow the tax brackets to fall from 9 to 8.75, from 7 to 6.5, and from 5 to 4.5%. As described in Section 1, and the conceptual amendment would just basically delete Section 3. And that's what I would like to offer.
Any questions?
I do apologize to the committee that I didn't, this is just one of those where time is fleeting to parallel.
Clarification, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Mr.
So we're just simply deleting Section 3. Just Section 4 will become our new Section 3. The standard. That's the date.
I'm sorry. Section 4, we also need to be deleted.
Yes. But we would just basically scratch Section 3, and Section 4. So it would still implement the first tax reduction in rates as described by Section 2 in the year 2002. And again, colleagues, the revenue impact on that as again described in the memo that I put out yesterday, would show for the taxable year, or the revenue impact for the year 2001 to 2003 is approximately $262 million, which is approximately what we've got before us in the A4 amendment. So, again, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to give us another alternative that parallels what your choice that the majority on this committee has offered up. And I would like to offer that as an alternative. And we can't do it today. Unless we could have a vote.
Make the conditional amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Beyer.
A question of Representative Edwards. Your bill or your amendment then would delete the A4's version of the bill, which we have today, and replace it with this, not in addition to the A4?
That is correct.
So the motion calling is in it to suspend the motion for the rules for purposes of conceptual amendment to the A6s and then amend them into the bill.
Correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Well, the motion will first be to suspend the rules and conceptually amend.
And that takes five votes to suspend the rules.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You can speak to the motion.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of like Section 3 of these amendments. I think that this idea a next step in the outer years. I think it's, I don't know, did you have a reason why you wanted that done? You just think that the first step enough to test something?
Okay. I think you did. Well, the issue, I guess, is at this point, what I see is if we're trying to make a policy decision about what taxes we're going to relieve, I believe it's fairer to give a cross-the-board tax cut than those who would gain under A4, which again has a benefit to a different tax bracket. And I just feel that if we're going to make that choice, we should give it across the board. The reason why I dropped the A3 was, and again, as I stated, the A3s and A4s is that I was not interested in making a proposal that was any different than what was being offered by the A4. And I apologize for the fact that I couldn't get this crafted. This is, time is running too quickly.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I guess I find myself in the same position that Representative Starr is, that if we're going to adopt the A6 amendments, I would prefer them with the dash with the Section 3 and Section 4 in the amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Devlin.
If we are to suspend the rules, Representative Edwards would be free to offer his version of the amendment. We'd have the opportunity to vote on it. If somebody wanted to offer a different amendment, they would have the opportunity to vote on it. So probably the sooner we move to motions, the sooner we decide whether or not we have a bill that can go off.
Well, we have a motion in front of it. If he suspend the rules, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I would prefer actually to see us proceed with the A4s, and if Mr. Edwards wanted to offer a minority report, that would be perfectly within his
Mr. Chairman, not to be pushy, but I'd prefer us to have a vote on the suspension of the rules.
Okay. Yes, pardon me, Richard Bennett.
As a matter of deference to my colleague, without seemingly disrespectful, I'd be willing to suspend the rules to allow him to make his motion as long as he understands I'm going to vote against his motion.
Yeah. Well, we'll call the roll on the motion to suspend the rules.
Everybody just goes without objection.
Aye. Aye.
Representative Byron.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Gorgon.
Aye.
Representative Mann.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Chair Simmons.
Aye. I'll make it unanimous. Motion carried. The rules are suspended. Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a little confused here. Do I need to offer the conceptual amendment to the A6, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I ask that we conceptually amend the A6 amendment to delete Section 3 and Section 4.
I apologize for the motion before us to delete. Conceptually amend the A6 amendment by deleting Section 3 and Section 4 of the bill. Any discussion on the motion?
I
would support the motion
if, in the end, we had a bill that had the A4 and the A6 in it. So I don't think that's too simple.
I'm not sure what that's not.
Mr. Chair, we are just on that. I think we had to do a whole new thing.
So
we'll quickly call a roll in motion.
Representative Byron.
No.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Gordon.
Aye.
Representative Mann.
No.
Representative Starr.
No.
Representative.
No. Okay. Motion having not received the required majority is carried.
Mr. Chair, did you accept the motion to adopt the
Byron?
Where they are?
I would have to vote against that, I'm afraid, today.
Can we recess for a moment, please?
I'd be happy to extend it for a moment.
I move the bill as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
I call for the motion for us to move the bill as amended to the floor of the House to be passed recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Devlin and Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chairman, I will be voting no in this committee today as vice chair of the committee party, but this is my service to represent my caucus. I will represent my caucus in voting no on this measure in committee. I may be voting yes on the floor.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You will see a minority report, and I believe it will look a lot like what the A6 had in mind, pared down a little bit. I just believe that if we're going to do a tax cut, and that this is a much more equitable way to do it, and that is across the board. And to give this, as it's described in the -A4, does benefit I've seen numbers over half the population of taxpayers. So, again, concept, I don't disagree, may be good policy. I think this is a much fairer way to give a tax relief. And as we all know, many people at all income levels have asked for some tax relief, if that's what the intent of the whole bill is. So I do hope that we will have another opportunity to vote on this. And I believe the alternative is a fairer, better way to go.
Representative Gardner, Representative Byron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just had a question at committee. Is there a breakdown of how this, what kind of a tax break this amounts to different taxpayers across the state?
We weren't given that information. Who's given the bottom line of what the impact would be?
Okay.
I can do a question. What numbers, how they got to the number.
Representative Byron.
I was going to say, Mr. Chair, is that, you know, it's my belief that the A4 amendment gives the tax break to the largest earning income people in the state of Oregon and not across the board. And just for the record, I'll be a no here today and on the floor. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to let Representative Edwards know that he is in fact going to do a minority report and wants the best chances to have it passed. He would include the A6 as it is drafted today. And he might just win that.
I appreciate that advice.
This is Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I occasionally differ from my caucus. Like I said today here, to make it clear that we're offering a minority report on voting with my Liberty Democratic members. I believe that the deductibility of federal income taxes should have been indexed some time ago. I know that there's been a very slippery on this in the state. I don't, with this being capped at 5,000, I don't see it impacting the wealthiest of Oregonians. I see it largely impacting middle-class Oregonians.
Yeah, I would concur with that. For the statement,
Mr. Chairman, actually, the A4 amendments, particularly since they involve a referral to the voters, which are now in the bill, are very important because we will rue the day that we didn't send something like this out as an alternative on this direct issue. I forget that Mr. Sizemore is going to successfully circulate his petition to much more drastically change the cap on the deductibility of federal income taxes. And some folks may not be aware that the rule of the things voted on by the citizens is if two things pass in the same election and one gets more votes than the other and they are inconsistent, the one that gets more votes supersedes the other. And the much more aggressive Sizemore initiative being on the ballot with this piece here on the same topic, I think a lot of the folks who support the Sizemore initiative would also vote for this to make sure something happens. And folks who are worried about the Sizemore initiative would also vote for this, thinking this is a more reasonable alternative. You put those two together, and that means more votes. Now, if they both are defeated, that's immaterial. If one passes and the other doesn't, it doesn't matter. But if they both pass, as I think they do, I predict that this piece will get more votes, and it will nullify the other initiative, and we will have a piece of, I'll call it tax equity from my perspective, which is much less radical than the initiative and something that we can live with in terms of the state income tax structure with an opportunity for adjustment over time, which I think is good too. I would have wanted this to be a little more radical, but I'll settle for what we have here. So I'll be a yes vote.
Representative Edwards?
To my good friend from Salem, I think what's troubling me in his argument today is that we are reacting to something that's theoretical that has not happened. And I just think writing tax policy because of something that may or may not happen is always a little dangerous, as we have seen in the past. I do believe, as has been pointed out, double taxation is a little awkward, and this does get to something that should be addressed, but I don't see how you can do it completely in isolation. And the last point is, and I guess I'll make another pitch for this, and I believe my good friend again from Salem would agree with this, is this is another reason why I think annual sessions could help this process, because again, if we're trying to react to something that is 2 years down the road, bringing us back in this building without a call to special session and forcing us, we could have another debate about this issue, having a better picture of what may or may not be on the ballot. But I guess I disagree with trying to project out something that's, you know, a campaign. We all know how difficult that is. So that isn't the rationale. I'm offering this as an alternative to what the majority in this committee is interested in passing on, as I believe has an equity piece to it.
Mr. Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd just like to point out to my good colleagues in Portland that this very committee, for one dissenting vote, and that would be mine, passed a bill not too long ago in response to a proposed Mr. Sizemore initiative that might happen, but they weren't even collecting signatures on yet.
Well, so you're consistent. So you should be a no.
Yes, Lieutenant Mack.
All I can say is back in the days when I had a D next to my name instead of an R, and there was talk about Measure 5, I talked to the leadership and I said, we should send something out because Sizemore is going to get it on the ballot and we should have an alternative that is less devastating. And they wouldn't do it. And the one thing Mr. Sizemore does manage to do is get things on the ballot, and he's good at that. And he is touching a raw nerve on a legitimate issue, which is the deductibility of the federal taxes paid. And if we don't have a rationale, and I say yes, 95% certainty it'll be on the ballot, and we know it'll be on in the general election in 2000. And now, I wouldn't put something on the ballot as an alternative if it's bad policy. I happen to think this is a good policy, and I just think if we just passed it down and got the governor to sign it, that wouldn't be smart because the ballot measure would supersede it. put this baby on the ballot. We can go out there and argue for good policy, and it's better policy than the more radical alternative, although I think there was an intermediate radical alternative that we could have done, but we haven't quite gotten there. I'll settle for that.
I would like to add, colleagues, to your comment that I consider this a very rare opportunity to be referring out to the voters a tax reduction measure from this building. And I am very pleased to be able to be here and do that. And in my 2 seconds of experience here in this building, all the money gets spent, and then some. And the only way, even though the prosperous times have been very good to the state of Oregon, and our revenues have increased very dramatically, at some point, that's going to change, and our economy is going to cool. And if we don't learn and begin to impose a little bit of fiscal responsibility, and reduce revenues a little bit, when the economy does cool, we have no place else to go. And I think this is good policy. I think it's prudent. I think the people of Oregon will thank us for sending this out to them. And if there are no further comments, we'll call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Evelyn.
No.
Representative Assembly.
No, and two possible notice of minority report.
Representative Gardner.
No.
Representative Gannon.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Thank you, Mr. Aye.
And the motion carries. And the bill goes before the House to do pass recommendation, and I'll call the bill.
Okay.
And
you can then go to care. We're going to
Okay. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 535. And we will go now to Senate Bill 1089. And Mr. Putnam. Bring us up to date with this thing. We do have new amendments today.
Yes, sir. 1089 was here, Mr. Chairman of the committee, a few days ago, and we modified the Senate version by changing the fees that applied to what are called dry stores. These are businesses that don't themselves do dry cleaning, but take in garments and pass them on to other facilities that do. As near as I can determine, an error was made in drafting those amendments, and the changes were not what was desired. So what is in front of us today is the B3 amendments, which I will pass out. What the B3 amendments do takes all of the fees back to what they were before this bill was ever introduced in the Senate. That's what it does. What is left in the bill, then, is authority for DEQ to levy penalties to certain people who do not pay their fees or post their notice of fees. And with that, I will pass out to you a hand of the gross version of it.
Thank you very much.
All of the changes, I believe, are that I just mentioned are on Cumplestone's page. Page 4. Lines 7 through 11 were restoring the previously deleted material and deleting the previously new material. And as I say, it simply gets rid of any change in the fees from what the bill of what the current law is.
How will that affect, Mr. Putman, the pooled funding, part of funds that DEQ uses to use cleanup?
I don't have a fiscal on these, but I believe it will add very little to the fund. The reason being the only revenue left in the bill is the $200 penalty for failing to for the cleaners to post a certain notice in their establishment. I can't imagine that that would happen very often.
Mm-hmm. And part of the motive for bringing this bill forward was that those fees are inadequate currently.
That's my understanding, yes.
The fund of money is inadequate currently.
Yes, they would like to have $1 million, and with the current fee structure, they're at about $500,000, as I understand it. This wouldn't take them clear to the million, but it will get them closer. And I've now found the amendments themselves.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, you want to move the bill?
Yeah. I think that's out of the question if you're not interested in it.
We've
got kind of a little bit musical chairs in here. People are in all the time. There's a few of us left here.
One of the most people from my minority report.
We could get that
far. Right, right. Say that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, would you go back and brief us over the effect of the new language in sections 4, 5, 6, and 7, and refresh my memory as to what we are trying to do here?
Well, the original bill attempted to do two things. It attempted to increase the amount of money in the fund to do cleanup for these sites. This is by no means, as I understand it, the only source of revenue, but it was an attempt to increase the number. The second thing is that there's actually a penalty now for failing to buy your certificate. This is in Section 5, to pay the annual fee and then post a notice, and without the notice, which tells the inspector whether or not the fee has been paid, that posted notice is a $200 penalty. So it's really an attempt to give the EQ a better handle on that, collecting the fees that are there now. Section 6 is to provide information to from revenue to DEQ. Oh, and I almost forgot. There's also, in addition to the $200 penalty for not posting the certificate, it's a $5,000 fine for actually not having paid the fee. But my view is that it adds to an enforcement fee, so it's nothing substantial for revenue.
The revenue situation will be the same as it is currently.
Normally the same, yes.
Has that fund been growing or just falling? What's going on there?
That I don't I can't answer that. I'll see if there's something in my notes that says anything about that. Well, it says here that the revenue collected through December 98 has been short of $1 million goal by about $250,000 each year.
Okay. So they're spending about as much as they're taking in.
Okay.
For sure. Okay. All righty. Well, colleagues, you have these amendments, and we'll give you overnight to digest these and get any other deficiencies you made. We'll digest these a little bit, make sure we get it right this time. We'll have to have this thing back and forth to the board many times in for the F and gross bill here. And so we will come back to this probably tomorrow and try to get it moved out of that.
Mr. Chairman, sorry, we might have missed part of the earlier conversation, but
with the amendments, with the agency and the industry on board?
We haven't heard from them yet on these new amendments. We have heard from some individual operators out around the state about these, and they've had some positive feedback.
Okay.
We'll close the work session on 10-9. We have several other pieces of business on our agenda today that we'll have to come back to. I anticipate being able to move through the entire agenda, but other issues are pending around some of these bills, and we will hopefully get back to them very soon. And we will be working this weekend. I'd like to be able to finish up all our work by Sunday, no later than Sunday. And I appreciate your support of the Congress and Devil.
Mr. Chairman, do we phone a meeting tomorrow morning?
No, we do not.
And second question, realizing that the agenda could still change, can we get a tentative agenda for Saturday, Friday afternoon?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And I have waiting meetings in the morning on Saturday, so if you schedule in the morning Saturday, I can juggle between the meetings, just so you're aware.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm on a sub-bone for
okay.
That move today.
Alrighty. It might be better. What time does the sub wrap up its work?
When we get done, I don't know. I'll take the other time. It's any day, any time.
Okay. It's full meeting after the sub.
Oh, it's that Sunday. It's okay.
Okay.
What's the room there?
We have four sessions and scheduled it for Saturday and Sunday.
Thank you. This committee.
This committee work.
Thanks.
Okay. Okay, then, we'll see another business for the committee. We are adjourned.